I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file sharing and personal data storage company that allows users to access their content from any of their devices. Drew co-founded Dropbox with his MIT classmate, Arash Ferdowsi, in 2007. Prior to starting Dropbox, Drew ran another startup, an online SAT prep company called Accolade. He incidentally scored 1600 on his SAT. Drew is from Acton, Massachusetts. Welcome.
Thank you.
There has been a great evolution in storage, from storing files of paper on a shelf to burning CDs to using memory sticks to now storing things in the cloud. How does Dropbox fit into all this?
Yeah, we think about the things you put in Dropbox are the things that kind of were things you'd store in your house, right? So you'd open your front door, you put your mail down on the table, photos on the coffee table in the living room, work documents in your briefcase, filing cabinet somewhere with your financial and health information. All that stuff lives on servers. All that stuff now lives on services like Dropbox. And so we all need our kind of digital home in the cloud. And we think of what we're building as kind of this magical home for all your most important information.
From the photos on your coffee table to, you know, your photos in the cloud, there's been a lot in between.
Right. Yeah, it's just a mess. Mm-hmm. When anytime some new technology comes along, the old stuff doesn't go away. You're taking all these pictures on your phone, but all your old computers, there's still photos stuck in all those places, and you still have the shoebox under your bed and the, you know, the photos on your fridge. And it's kind of up to you to kind of duct tape all this stuff together.
We talk about storage in the cloud, but there are servers that are actually helping to maintain this. Where do your servers live?
So there's a lot of them. They live on both the West and East Coast. You know, in case anything happens in any place, your stuff will always be safe. Since the beginning, we manage and buy and operate a bunch of our own servers, and then we've also used the public cloud, which refers to places like Amazon. They have Amazon Web Services, and they buy a bunch of servers and manage them and rent them out to companies like ours. And that made it really easy for us to get started because, you know, back then we couldn't afford to spend tens of millions of dollars on equipment, and we could just get started with a credit card.
When did you first think of the idea for Dropbox?
Well, it was out of personal frustration. And one day I forgot my thumb drive. I was taking a trip from Boston to New York. I justified this in my head because I was going to spend the weekend there by thinking of, oh, if I take the bus, I can have, you know, 4.5 hours in each direction. And so 9 hours to get all these things done. And so rush to the bus, get on there, have a seat, open up my laptop. And I paused and had that feeling in the pit of my stomach. I just knew that I had left my little thumb drive with all my company stuff on it back at home. And these were the days before the iPhone and kind of thing where if you didn't have anything to do, you really didn't have anything to do. So I had 4.5 hours to think about how disorganized I am, and I'm like, I never want to have this problem again.
Now, there's a lot of like myth founding stories. Is that actually what happened, or had you been kind of marinating on versions of this even before that momentous epiphany?
Well, I had, at the time, there were all kinds of other services that claimed to do this on paper. At MIT, I had hacked together a bunch of little tools to try to help me manage this. But it was really that bus ride where the first lines of code, I started typing in the first lines of code.
Now, you applied to Y Combinator, which is a seed accelerator or an incubator that in exchange for equity, they give you now roughly, I think, $120,000 to help you get your business started.
They were a little leaner than me.
They were. It was more like
$15,000. Like
$15,000, right. Paul Graham said to you, well, you need to find a co-founder if we're going to accept you.
Right.
Now, you had had a co-founder prior. He was a Stanford grad, but he couldn't join you because he had a friend who was starting like a competing technology. So you went to Arash, who had gone to MIT, but you didn't know him at MIT. How did that happen?
It's kind of long story. A little bit of co-founder musical chairs. So it turned out, as you said, I had a bunch of people who would have been great, but just timing wasn't right. And I was just complaining to anyone who would listen that I'd need a co-founder. And what happened was a friend of mine who I'd also met at MIT named Kyle he knew Arash, and he's like, you guys should really talk. And so we got together in the student center. I think there was a coffee house on the second floor. And now in retrospect, it's kind of crazy because we spent maybe a total of a couple hours together before completely jumping in.
And he dropped out of MIT.
Yeah, it was wild.
So you and Arash completed Y Combinator, and that led you accidentally to another person named Pejman Nozad.
Yeah, Pejman Nozad.
And he was talking Farsi to Arash because they both happened to be Iranian, and he was taken with your technology. And he was kind of a pivotal person for you very early on because he introduced you to Sequoia, to your first venture capital.
Yeah, it was wild. Pejman came running up to Arash after our demo at Y Combinator, but we hadn't really heard of him, but he was very persistent and convinced us to come down, and we'd type in the address, and we'd go down to Palo Alto on University Ave, and we'd get out of the car, and we're like, oh man, we're already running late. This is the wrong place. This is some like rug gallery. But we go inside, and we're like, hey, we probably have the wrong place, but it's Pejman here. The receptionist's like, oh sure, come back here, and you know, you look around, it's just rugs. But we go through this like secret back doorway into this boardroom, and we sit down. They serve us Persian tea. We walk him through a demo, and next thing we know, he's introducing us to Sequoia. He came with us to the first pitch.
It was his family's rug company that he was operating from, and he actually said to Sequoia, "Oh yes, you know, they're talking to other venture capitalists who want to invest to just
move things along."
And Michael Moritz from Sequoia shows up at your apartment one Saturday morning to say, "Here is your $1.2 million." is that accurate?
More or less, yeah. We go to Sequoia on a Friday, and I get a phone call that night saying, "Hey, you know, we really like you guys. Next step is usually to have a partners meeting on Monday, but Mike isn't going to be there. Can he come visit on Saturday morning?" And I'm thinking, Mike. And I was like, oh God, yeah, Mike Moritz, who's like the godfather of Sequoia. And yeah, next thing you know, he's in our living room. Our boxes literally aren't even unpacked. And we're walking him through a tour of Dropbox.
I want to go back to your Y Combinator application for a moment, because we're talking about raising capital, and they ask you about that on the application. You know, if somebody's interested in buying your company, you know, what would you do? And you'd said, I'd rather see the idea through, but I'd probably have a hard time turning down $1 million after taxes for 6 months of work.
Right.
But then Steve Jobs offers you 9 digits in 2009. How did you come into contact with Steve originally?
Dropbox was kind of on their radar.
Because you had hacked their system.
The team at Apple had gotten in touch because we did some kind of crazy technical acrobatics with the operating system. And so we did this kind of open heart surgery on this thing called the Finder, which is what shows you your files, which is technically a very difficult thing to do. And so they were confused. They're like, how did you guys do that? And we were thinking, why are you asking us? Like, you guys, aren't the people who do that like 100 feet away from you? That was what started things. And then they wanted to have conversations about maybe buying the company and eventually kind of move up the food chain to Steve.
What surprised you about the encounter?
Our meeting with Steve was really cordial. And the encounters usually fell into two buckets. You either got chill Steve or very angry Steve. Fortunately, it was the former. He's just like, look, you should join us. And we said, look, we're huge admirers of everything you've done, but we're really having a great time building this company. I'm sure you understand. That's when I thought he'd get upset. But he started taunting us a little bit and saying all these reasons why it wouldn't work, or, you know, it was unlikely to work, and how they were going to have to compete with us and kill us and these kinds of things. But what was fun about it was that it was all kind of done in 15 minutes, and he spent the next 45 minutes just talking to us about entrepreneurship and his path. And you know, I was asking him all these questions about why'd he come back to Apple, and he didn't have to do that.
And P.S., he comes out with iCloud, which is a competitor to Dropbox, but you knew it was coming because he told you he was coming out with a cloud-based solution similar to yours. And even at the time, you know, your customer base wasn't obviously what it is today. You have over 300 million users.
Right.
But at the time, it was more like 2 million?
It's probably about 2 million.
And you acquired those customers in kind of quirky ways. One was with referrals, that if a user referred a friend, that they got more storage for free.
Yeah.
And that was kind of taking a page out of PayPal's playbook, right?
Right. If I tell you about Dropbox, you get some free space, I get some free space. We found that of all the things we tried, that was really effective. And people would try to collect space, kind of like points, even if they didn't use it. That quickly became the primary way that people found out about Dropbox.
You also made a video in the middle of the night demonstrating the service. Very simple. That really resonated mostly with the tech community.
Right. So it was this quick video just narrating the experience of Dropbox. But what we did was we put all these little Easter eggs in the video that people who frequently went to sites like Reddit or Dig, things that that community would understand. And so I learned that from a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which is how do you reach people when you have no money? And it just took off. I mean, hundreds of thousands of people visited in the first day. 75,000 people signed up to try Dropbox. It was literally overnight that we built our critical mass.
By the way, you said you read it in a book called Guerrilla Marketing, which I'm guessing you read on the roof of your fraternity at MIT, where you got your default MBA.
Yes.
And which I'll get to later. But I want to talk about that video, because as I was watching the video, I saw some like very funny names for files laying around. Like you had one file called People Have No Idea Why They're Doing What They're Doing. Did you make up these file names?
Yeah. Even if you weren't interested in Dropbox, something in there might catch your attention. So there are always funny file names. There's XKCD comics. There's a picture of Tom Cruise jumping on a couch. There's references to Obama. He was campaigning back then. We found that it worked.
So where do you get your sense of humor from?
I guess that's a good question. I think, you know, my mom has a great sense of humor. Both of my parents are pretty light-hearted and funny.
I have to admit, I kind of fell into using your service because when I was downloading photos from my iPhone one day, Dropbox kind of appeared and I almost had to use it. Now I'm locked into you forever because even though I had your service for free initially, I now have to pay you monthly?
Mm-hmm. Monthly, yearly.
So you are a Trojan horse in a way. You know, on the one hand, I'm grateful because I know, okay, my photos are safe in addition to the other places I store it. But on the other hand, I'm like, I'm going to have to pay this service ongoing. And that's obviously your hope.
Right.
How do you navigate that? What percent of the people who use Dropbox pay for the service?
Most of the users are free users. But obviously that's how we make the model work is that if you need more space, you can subscribe. But we have to earn that. And so we're always doing more to make the experience better. And hopefully when you look at your credit card statement, it's one of the things that makes you happy and not sad.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. We'll hear more from Drew coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. Drew graduated from MIT in 2006, and before starting Dropbox, he founded an online SAT prep company called Accolade and created a poker bot, which helps you win at online poker. Who knew?
That's right.
Are you a poker player?
I am. Not a great poker player.
Was this like a for-profit endeavor or just something that you were kind of having fun reverse engineering software on a computer one day?
It was a little of both. So I love poker, but what was appealing since I was little, I've always loved taking things apart. You know, whether it's online poker or all kinds of things, I was able to figure out sort of from the inner workings of how the poker app worked, and I was able to create something where the mouse would move itself and click and figure out what's going on with the game and the artificial intelligence to play. But then, unfortunately, in 2006, poker became illegal or more illegal. And so, you know, I thought to really scale this out would be a lot of different felonies you'd have to commit. Mm-hmm. So I decided to put my attention elsewhere.
There's an image or a story I've heard about you going up to New Hampshire to visit your family in their cottage. You have a car full of your computers and wires to work on this poker bot. Can you tell me about just what that looked like?
Yeah. So we have a little place in New Hampshire on a lake. And, you know, most normal people like go swimming and canoeing around and things like that. And, you know, I drive by and, you know, my mom's like saying, like says hello, and I'm dragging three monitors out of my trunk and setting them up on, it's like I put them on the stove, and I was hooking everything up, and my mom was like, what are you doing? But she knew, this is one of many kind of schemes and projects I've had.
What was your mother's view of that sort of ingenuity?
She's always found it just funny and, you know, just entertaining to watch me and my siblings. My parents, I'm really lucky, and they've always been supportive of everything I've done. They find all of this just pretty funny.
What do your parents do?
So my mom, she just retired. She was a high school librarian at my high school. And my dad is a staff engineer at Draper Lab in Cambridge.
I heard that you've been coding since you were 5 years old.
That's right.
What does that mean? How does a five-year-old code?
So I was lucky. And when I was in diapers and sort of running into the living room, my dad had bought a PC Junior. And so I would, even before I could really read or do anything, I was kind of mashing the keys and eventually got to the point where my dad was able to show me how to play games and write my first lines of code.
Did you get outdoors a lot, though, as well?
Yes. My siblings and I were limited in our computer time, so we'd have to take turns and be normal for the rest of the time.
We alluded to this at the beginning, but your mom was a librarian, and did it kind of resonate with you that what you're doing is kind of a later form of library work?
We think about that a lot. We store a ton of information in Dropbox, as you can imagine, with hundreds of millions of people using the service. And every day, people store probably dozens of libraries of Congress. Mm-hmm. This is every day.
I want to talk about a speech that you gave at MIT. You talk about the circle of five, which basically is the five people in your life you spent most time with. Can you describe that briefly?
So I think there was a quote I read somewhere that you're the average of the five people you spend time with the most. It's an interesting observation for me because it prompted me to do a lot of different things. It prompted me to move out to San Francisco because that's kind of what Hollywood is to the entertainment industry. Silicon Valley and San Francisco are to internet companies. And when I think of what some of the most important, sort of in retrospect, what some of the most important things I've done, it's really been going to places like MIT, surrounding myself with people that push me in sort of friendly competition.
And one of those people for you was Adam Smith, who was a classmate of yours from MIT. And you say that you would code in your boxers at your fraternity because the air conditioning didn't work. And all of a sudden, you know, he's getting serious and he's getting venture capital and he's getting flown around in helicopters. And that was just the kick in the butt that you needed. Can you describe that?
Yeah. So Adam started a company but almost exactly a year before me. And we would spend the summer coding together, and he was working on his company, and I was working on my first company. But very quickly, after that summer, he moved out to California. And next thing I knew, I get this phone call from him saying, hey, this investor, Vinod Khosla, is going to give me $5 million.
And Vinod Khosla, for those who don't know,
is the founder, one of the co-founders of Sun Microsystems. He's this really legendary character in the Valley, and he has a big venture capital firm. And so I was just shocked. I mean, I was super happy for him, but at the same time, I'm like, oh my God, I'm not getting Publishers Clearinghouse size checks.
And this is the friendly competition you're talking about. In addition to talking about, you know, the circle of five, you talk about the tennis ball. What is that?
When I was working on my first company, after a while, I sort of lost steam. And I thought something's wrong with me, or like, why can't I work hard? But then actually, the PokerBot was the project that reminded me that I was obsessed with that thing. And when I think of that kind of obsession, I thought of our dog growing up, Whimsy. When you would throw a tennis ball, she would just go bounding after it, like bashing through stuff, just kind of just tongue hanging out, just looking a little bit crazy. And when I think about people who have done really amazing things, it's really kind of that obsession. And that's what I recognized when I started working on Dropbox. This is a problem I can be really excited about for a long time.
Even though you're young, you're also mindful of kind of your numbered days. And, you know, you read somewhere that you have basically 30,000 days to live.
I remember this one night right after moving to San Francisco, reading that, that you live for 30,000 days. And, you know, at first I'm like, okay, this is like a clinically obvious fact. But on a whim, I just opened up the calculator and I typed it in, and I'm like, oh my God, Like, I was 24 at the time or something, and I'm like, I'm like 9,000 days down, almost a third of the way through life. That was just kind of a shock to me that, you know, every day we kind of get a ticket until you don't. And so it really caused me to think about how do you make every day count?
So what's an example of how that influences what you're doing?
For a lot of life, you spend your time like checking boxes and like getting ready to do things. And when I look at a lot of my friends, a lot of them may have wanted to start a company at some point, but they kind of get trapped. They basically spend all these years getting ready to start a company, and then before they know it, they've got kids and a mortgage, and they just don't have the flexibility they had. Instead of trying to get ready, I was just like, all right, I'm just going to do this.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. You mentioned in your application to Y Combinator that you were in a crowded, hostile, competitive environment and that there were lots of companies trying to do what you were doing. And I actually appreciated your candor in the application. You know, you're saying, yeah, you know what? There's not a lot of barriers to entry, but what makes us different is that we're going to execute carefully. What made you think you could do it better or execute better than others? And why were you not daunted by going into such a crowded sector?
What we would say to investors is like, look, if, you know, if any of these things worked, like I wouldn't be here. I'd just use that. Tom Cruise in Minority Report, do you really think he's going to be like carrying a thumb drive around? Right? Or like logging into his Gmail to pick up the thing he had like emailed himself. Mm-hmm. Like obviously your stuff would just follow you around, and mm-hmm. that's not our idea. That idea has been around since my parents were kids. But none of us had that. We had it sort of at school, but then you graduate and it's like back to the Stone Age, and I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I'm my own IT guy. There are a lot of startup ideas that are kind of like that, where it's a terrible idea. Like mobile was like that for a long time. It's just this graveyard until one day, you know, the iPhone comes along and it just works. Or music startups, you know, just didn't work. Then you have Spotify and Pandora. And so I think if the problem is still unsolved, it doesn't really matter how many competitors there are.
Because, though, of the competitive space, the costs are so low, and you talk about file sharing just being chapter one of what you're doing.
Sure.
You're constantly having to innovate, where you're going beyond just being that file sharing service.
Well, our space is evolving, and mm-hmm. it's like any other technology. So, I mean, think about your first cell phone. In the beginning, you're like, oh, my God, I can be in my car, and I can be talking. This is like magic. And you're like, okay, how many minutes do I have for my phone calls? Now cell phones do much more than just phone calls. Dropbox is kind of like that, where it's like, oh, I can have my stuff with me wherever I am. I can access it from anywhere. How much space do I have? Now everybody knows that the storage is just an ingredient, mm-hmm. and it's a means to an end. But what people are really doing is they want to have everything in one place. They want to share. They want to collaborate. They want to get work done. And so those are the real problems we're solving. And things like sync or storage, we don't even really use those words that much because what we're really trying to do is solve the underlying problems.
You originally did not have the URL dropbox.com. It was getdropbox.com. And you even started with Evenflow as the name of the company. Can you tell me the story about how you acquired the domain name?
Yeah, getting the domain name was kind of a crazy...
Because somebody else owned it.
Yeah, so we didn't have dropbox.com in the beginning. We had getdropbox.com, so kind of a budget domain name.
How much did you pay for Dropbox ultimately?
We have to keep that secret, unfortunately. But what happened was there's this guy who lived in Pleasanton, which is near San Francisco, and for the first couple of years I was running the company, I would call him and be like, hey, you know, we have an idea for this thing that we want to build. We see that you have Dropbox.com. Can we work something out? And he would say no every time. He's like, and we're like, why? And he's like, oh, I have a project. And it was clear after call 3, 4, 5, 10 that there was no project. And eventually we got so frustrated that we go downstairs, go to the convenience store, like buy the most expensive bottle of $40 champagne we could find, and get in a Zipcar and drive to his house and ring the doorbell. And he's a little shocked, but the crazy thing, he was an entrepreneur too. And so he sat us down. We tell him a little bit more about what we're doing. And he's like, this is interesting. Let me think about it. And we're like, this is really exciting. Awesome. We'll give you stock. We got great investors, all these things. I'm trying to get him interested. And he's like, I'll talk to you in a couple of days. We're like, we'll be back on Monday. Mm-hmm. And so we come back. We're like, you know, what do you think? He's like, no, I'm just going to hang on to it. And I'm like, are you serious? Like, you're going to like bequeath it to your children? Like, what is the end game here? And he was just totally unreasonable. And what happened was he ended up putting all these ads on it that would confuse our users. So we actually ended up sort of, you know, rattling our swords and filing a lawsuit for trademark infringement because it was actually causing confusion. Our users were going to clicking on these ads and he was making all this money off of confusing people. And so you can't do that. So eventually we got back in touch with him. We're like, look, you know, neither of us wants to be in sort of embroiled in something like this. And finally we were able to, he was able to sell it to us. And he probably should have taken stock. He sold it for cash, probably worth $100 million. Mm-hmm. So just a lot. Right. Paid him a lot less.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox, a file hosting service that allows you to store, share, and access your personal data among any of your devices. In addition to like customer acquisition and getting venture capital, what was one or two key pivotal moments in the progression of Dropbox in the early days?
Really getting people to understand how to use the product. And what I mean by that is we could see in the numbers that a lot of people would sign up and not start using it, which is always puzzling. And literally in a given day, you would see a note from someone saying, hey, this is like a godsend. This is the simplest, best thing ever. And the next email would be like, what is wrong with you guys? You need MIT nerds. Like, you need a PhD to figure this thing out. It's totally impenetrable, and I hate it. And so what we did was we went on Craigslist and offered like $30 or something if you would come in and try Dropbox, and we just put a camera in there. I had a bunch of music equipment, so we would record people just trying out the product. And we found all of these hidden things that were these stumbling blocks. And it was really simple. We're just like, hey, have a seat. Here's an invitation email to Dropbox. Go from here to sharing a file with this email address. 0 of 5 succeeded. Like, they all, like, failed with prejudice. Like, most of them didn't even figure out how to get the thing installed.
Is that because of trouble in the coding? Bugs in the coding?
You know, it's just kind of unexpected stuff. You know, after you install Dropbox, really, in a sense, it just puts you into this empty folder. And the only interaction you can have with it is through this little icon in the corner of your screen. And so people didn't notice the icon. They didn't notice that we were putting the folder there. They were totally baffled as to what this thing was. And so after that, we made a list of like 80 things that were confusing that we didn't even realize until, and they're all obvious in retrospect, but mm-hmm. And then we just kind of grinding through them.
That really helped to enhance the ease of use.
Yeah, it was a pivotal moment for us because I think it's really hard to see through your customer's eyes,
right?
Especially if you know every facet of every line of code and know exactly how the thing works. Right. You know, you're almost like screaming through the screen, like, just click the icon, it's right there. How can you not see it?
What are some examples of anecdotes of people actually having success with this service?
I think it's really amazing to me how much it sort of feels like Dropbox has become part of the fabric of how we do all kinds of things. And, you know, everything from, you know, SNL, you know, watch the 40th anniversary SNL episode, that's produced in Dropbox. Mm-hmm. You know, you turn on music, and pretty much every musician I talk to uses Dropbox. Or National Geographic, like all the flipping through the beautiful photos they have, that's all in Dropbox.
Now, when you say they're using Dropbox, so they're working collaboratively with other people on the files, on the content.
Right. And so they're moving big files around, they're collaborating.
What are other examples?
Someone emailed in, they're like, hey, we use Dropbox at this hospital, and it got flooded, and all of our patients' records were destroyed. But we had a backup in Dropbox, so it literally like saved people's lives. Mm-hmm. To more mundane or just sort of off the wall stuff. To our first head of marketing was here in New York and visiting her hairdresser, and they're making small talk. She's like, "Oh, where do you work?" And Julia's like, "I'm at Dropbox," and the hairdresser like dropped her stuff, and she's like, "I love Dropbox. It's completely changed my life." And Julie's like, what? You know, the hairdresser, you know, makeup artist, not really the first target market we'd think of. And Julie's like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, I do all this production work for this movie. We have to shoot all the scenes out of order. And I got to run around with a clipboard writing down, like, your hair is here and you're wearing this earring and your bracelet and, you know, your sleeves are up. And it's a huge pain because I can't get anything wrong. But now all I do, I have an iPad. All the pre-production footage is in Dropbox. I just see, and when I want to see what were you wearing in the scene before this, I just look at the scene before it. and it's completely saved, you know, hours and hours and hours of my life. Never would have occurred to us that we're like creating like hairdresser workflow software.
And where do you store your data?
Oh my God, it's all in Dropbox.
All?
Yeah, as much as I can.
No iCloud?
So for like Find My iPhone, I use iCloud. You know, really all of us are going to end up using all of these services, and that creates a new problem. Like I need like a cloud to connect my clouds.
You love music. How long have you been playing the guitar?
Since the senior year in high school.
Your band Angry Flannel performs from time to time.
Yes.
Why the name Angry Flannel?
We basically had all gotten together. We didn't know each other that well, and we were bickering over the name. And we had interviewed a lot of bad singers. And I think afterwards, and everybody was all emotional, and I'm like, what are we here, like Angry Flannel or something? And it stuck. I had a chance to track down Eddie Vedder, who was the lead singer of Pearl Jam. They're investors in Dropbox. So he liked the name. He approved.
And speaking of Pearl Jam, Dropbox was originally called Evenflow, which is a Pearl Jam song.
Yes.
Tell me about that.
I've been a big Pearl Jam fan for a long time. And we were worried because Dropbox.com wasn't available. If I wasn't going to put Dropbox, I had to put something in. So I'm a huge Pearl Jam fan, and the first name of the company, our incorporation certificate, still says Evenflow Inc.
And in addition to Pearl Jam being an investor, you too is an investor.
Yes.
Do you secretly wish you were a rock star?
I think that would be a pretty good path. You know, if I could take a year and like tour or be part of something like that, that would be really fun.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Drew Houston, co-founder of Dropbox. Coming up, we'll meet Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits, a hardware company that produces electronic modules that snap together with magnets. These electronic modules are accessible to both children and adults, and the company's goal is to encourage creativity and invention by making electronics easier to use. Little Bits was launched in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya graduated with a degree in computer engineering from American University in Beirut and has a master's from the MIT Media Lab. Aya is also an interactive artist. Welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
You grew up in Lebanon. You were always encouraged down the engineering route. How come?
So I actually wanted to be a designer when I was in school, but I was very good at math and science. And so my family, my parents and my teachers told me that I owed it to myself to be an engineer. And I went into engineering because it was sort of the thing to do. But very quickly, I realized that engineering was very dry and very much not creative. And I felt like there was a big piece of my brain, like my the creative portion, that was really not engaged. And so those were the seeds of some of the work that I ended up doing with Little Bits.
And also, you are an interactive artist, meaning that you are using technology in your art. Mm. And your focus is on perceptions of Arabian identity. One of your works is Arabia. Tell me about that.
So that was a project that came from a personal place. I had moved to the U.S. For a couple of years, and more frequently than I thought, I would get comments from people that say, "Oh, you're Arab. How come you're not wearing a veil? Or you're Arab. Are you able to belly dance?" And I would get these like very polarized cliches thrown at me all the time. And I'd never thought of these things when I was growing up. And so, Arabia was basically a piece that I developed for a fashion show. It's a belly dancing outfit, and you have the model, the dancer, comes out to the stage and performs this really beautiful, very sensual dance. And then at one point, she flips a switch on her outfit, and through motors, the outfit starts to close on itself and turns into a burqa, just showing these two extremes of stereotypes associated with Arab women.
You're using technology and electronics in your artwork. work playing with the two. And that's what you're encouraging people to do through little bits, basically, just to create and be inventive. What are some examples of some of the projects that the general public creates with Little Bic kits?
At the root, what we are doing, our mission is to put the power of electronics in everyone's hands and make anyone an inventor. We've been described as Lego for electronics or Lego for the 21st century. So they are bricks that instead of being plastic, are lights and sounds and sensors and motors. And with the same ease, you can start using them. Kids have used them to learn about electronics or to create line-following robots. They've created, yesterday we saw a kid who made a flute that makes soap bubbles as he's blowing into the flute through a fan and some sensors. Also things that, you know, there's a lot of energy and attention towards the Internet of Things now. And we do have, with Little Bits, this ability to attach the Internet to anything so that you can bring appliances or devices at home to life and make them controllable with your phone. So we've seen people, for example, make something like a remote pet feeder so that if you're at home at the office and your pet is hungry, you can, through your phone, press a button and have a little motor turn a cup of food for your pets so you can feed them remotely.
You, in 2008, came up with the idea or the early prototypes for Little Bits, but it wasn't until 2011 that you actually launched the company. And it was your boyfriend who encouraged you to kind of stop everything else that you were doing. What's the story there?
So in about April 2011, I had been working on Little Bits as a project, as one of my projects for a few years. And I had gone and found a factory to make it, and was doing prototypes. And in April 2011, I got the first shipment of a prototype from a factory that I'd been working with in China. And for the first time, I basically saw that Little Bits was manufacturable. And simultaneously, I'd been getting a good amount of press that was interested in the concept of kind of making electronics accessible to kids and adults. And so people would write in wanting to place orders. And so my boyfriend said, you have a product that's manufacturable and you have a customer that wants it. You need to stop everything else you're doing and start a company. And it was kind of like, oh, yeah, why not?
Is he still your boyfriend?
He's my husband now, yes.
Where did you meet him?
I met him in New York, actually. He co-curated a show with MoMA, with Paola Antonelli, called Design and the Elastic Mind, that was about design and science. He was chairing the conference, and I was giving a talk there.
In 2011, shortly after you launched, there was an exhibit at MoMA, or the Museum of Modern Art, where Little Bits was displayed, and Little Bits is now in the permanent collection. Can you tell me about that?
Sure. So there was an exhibit called Talk to Me by Paola Antonelli, who's the head design curator. And the exhibit was about the interaction between people and things. And Little Bits was on display in that exhibit. And it was a huge, huge honor because it was with some of the greatest design and technology pieces of the day. Shortly thereafter, they sent me an email saying that they wanted to acquire Little Bits into the permanent collection of the museum.
One of the germs for Little Bits was the creation of the concrete brick, which you've talked about before, invented in 1868. What is the connection of the concrete brick to your modules?
I believe that, you know, the world keeps changing and the technologies of the day are moving fast. And so in the early 1900s, the technology of the day was a concrete brick. That was the way we started to build larger, more complex structures, one brick at a time. And a little bit after, Lego came out with a play version of that brick in order to empower young and the young at heart to be able to play with that technology that was really ruling the world and be able to make buildings and bridges and these beautiful structures one brick at a time.
And they were called the automatic bonding brick?
Automatic bonding brick was the first name that they had. And now the world has changed again. Now the brick is no longer a cement brick. The brick is now a transistor, which is something that is driving all the technologies around us. The devices we carry, our phones, our alarm systems, they all at their node have a transistor. And so what is the play or the imagination version of that brick? How can we put that in the hands of the kids and kids at heart so that they can kind of understand the world and reinvent it? And that's sort of what drove a lot of the work on Little Bits.
What were a few pivot points for you for the company where you felt like you were getting traction from the public?
MoMA was definitely one. In September 2011, basically it was the day I launched the company, and at the same time we were acquired into the permanent collection. So it really kind of started us off on a really strong footing and with a lot of confidence and kind of a big stage to play on. And then in February 2012, I became a TED fellow and I gave a talk at TED, which was also a pivotal moment. It was really a chance to talk about why this is important and why this is important for society, not as a gadget or a toy. It's important as a new way of thinking.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Aya Bedir, founder of Little Bits, a company that sells electronic modules that snap together using magnets. These modules are generally easy to use, making them appealing to the general population, both adults and children. The company was started in 2011, and the kits are sold in more than 70 countries. Aya is also an interactive artist raised in Beirut, Lebanon.
You asked actually on pivotal moments. There is one more. Early on in the company, when we launched, we got an email from NASA, from the education department at NASA, saying that they wanted to collaborate with us to create kits to make space and Earth exploration more attractive to kids. And they came to us saying, you know, we need your help. And that was a huge moment. And we collaborated together to create a kit called the Space Kit, which replicates some, to a high degree of fidelity, some experiments that are happening at NASA that make this wonder around space and Earth more palatable and more understandable.
What's an example?
You know, in order to wake up astronauts in the space station, NASA sends wirelessly some music to play music as an alarm. And we have a little experiment where you have a microphone and you're playing music from your phone or an MP3 player, and you're transmitting this wirelessly through infrared to a speaker somewhere else.
Ironic that your family really pushed you hard to become an engineer and go down this route, and you did it resentfully as you really wanted to pursue your art, and now you're back where you started.
Absolutely.
With a twist.
Yeah, with a twist.
What does your mother make of this?
My mother has been a huge, huge influence and inspiration on me. When I was growing up, she was doing her master's when I was about 6 or 8. So I would come home and we would do homework together. And so even though I grew up in the Arab world, I never had any idea that there was sort of a different career choices that women and men made. And she's very supportive today as well.
You are part of the maker movement or the open hardware movement. Can you describe that?
The maker movement is really a movement that started around this idea that we should not be just consuming objects around us, that humans were made to be creative and to make with their hands. And that's how you learn. It's how you connect with friends. It's how you invent. And the maker movement is all about sort of making things for yourselves, whether it's arts and crafts, whether it's making electronics. It's really about putting the power back in the hands of the people instead of just the large companies. I do remember kind of early in the 2000s, you started to really see a world where everything was a screen and everything was virtual and every relationship was happening online. And for a lot of people, myself included, that's not a pretty world that I would like to live in. I believe in the tactile. I believe in feeling the satisfaction of having made something. And so what happened is I think that we realized that software in kind of the cloud or in virtual space, without it being on objects and in objects around us, becomes really intimidating and almost not human. And so now the pendulum swung back again to say, all of the things we learned from software, how can we now embed them into devices of all sizes and spaces that are around us?
You attended the iBeam Art and Tech Center in New York. How important was that in the evolution of Little Bits? And what is it?
iBeam is an art and technology lab and center in New York. That was a very, very, very pivotal moment in my life. I had done engineering, and then I went to the media lab at MIT and was doing sort of engineering and art and doing a lot of research around that subject. And then I graduated in 2006 and got a job in finance. And I did finance for 2 years, and I was very, very miserable. And I didn't want to be doing PowerPoints and meeting with hedge funds. And so I quit, and I got a fellowship at IBM. And at IBM, I picked up these ideas of incorporating electronic with arts, and then Little Bits was a second project, just to think about, you know, how do I put this ability to use electronics for creativity, how do I put this ability in the hands of other people, not just myself, which is sort of the genesis of Little Bits.
In addition to selling these modules, the community aspect of Little Bits has really developed. You have something called a Maker Hub, where people are on your site sharing what they've made, as well as BitLab, which is basically an app store for hardware.
So on the first piece, the community, basically, you know, because Little Bits is essentially a system of these electronic bricks, you know, the point is not the bricks, the point is what you make with them. And so we have a space on the website where there are thousands of projects that people have uploaded with step-by-step tutorials for things you can make. You then have kids that are 8 years old and adults that are 45 years old collaborating on an idea.
What's an example?
We have one of our community members that made basically a surf weather alert because he wanted to know when it was a good tide to go surfing. And so basically connected this motor to make a display that's on a beach that reads from weather data to get like high tide, low tide, and basically creates these notifications that go back and forth and tell him now it's a good time to surf. And that's an example of a collaboration that was across different ages and experiences.
I want to talk about the design of the product. They're white circuit boards with very colorful connectors, pink and blue and green. Can you talk to me about some of those choices?
Electronics are always ugly. They're always green or black, and there's wires sticking out everywhere. And they're the thing you put inside something. You make a shell around it to cover them. And part of sort of the challenge was, how do you make electronics not intimidating? How do you make them inviting? And so one of the tools to cross that hurdle is to make them beautiful, make them exposed so they're open. They're not hidden under any box. They're white because it's less sort of scary. They have this handwritten font on them because it makes them feel human. And they have these neon-colored connectors because we want them to be gender-neutral. People gravitate towards them that never would have put their hand on electronics, whether it's kids, particularly young girls, but also entrepreneurs, designers, artists, people that have no engineering training whatsoever or no interest in engineering.
You mentioned gender-neutral. Neutrality. In what ways are you mindful of encouraging girls to pick up the product?
Getting more girls and women into technology is a hidden agenda of the company, but we don't wear it on our sleeve. What we do is make very, very deliberate choices to make sure that the product, the communication around the product, and everything the company stands for is egalitarian.
I want to talk about venture capital for a moment. You've raised a couple...
So fun.
You've raised a few rounds of venture capital. What have been your impressions of that process along the way?
Raising money is not easy in general. But in addition to that, raising money for a hardware company is difficult. I remember early on in one of my pitches, one investor, very, very prominent investor, told me, "I love your business. I love everything you're doing. I think it's going to be a smashing success, but I can't invest in you. Your business is too much of a real business for us. There is the reality. There's physical product and raw material and shipping and taxes and warehouses. And, you know, the barrier to being successful is much higher than making a piece of software and getting a million people to use it." So the hardware component adds to the complexity of raising money. I don't actively think about it, but there is an extra stigma of being a woman.
What is one example?
I'd rather not proliferate the anecdotes, and instead I'll say what I learned and what I think is a proactive way to solve it. I think that the generation before us fought a very hard fight, and we stand on their shoulders for being able to do the things that we're able to do. But now we have a different fight to fight, which is do great work. And I think that the best way to succeed is something that actually Sarah Silverman said once in one of her shows, which is just be undeniable. Be undeniable. And then nobody can come in and say, but she's a woman. It will not happen. And then the third reason why it's difficult to raise money is I got a good piece of advice early on, which is not all money is equal. You can get money from anywhere, but getting the right kind of money or smart money is transformative.
Your modules allow you to do a whole array of things, of one of which most recently is to make music. And you have all these modules in front of me. Can you make some music for me?
Sure. So what I have is a power bit, which is blue, and I'm going to snap it into an oscillator, which is generating the sound wave, and a speaker. And now I'm tuning the oscillator. And then I can put a keyboard. Add a sequencer.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
My guest has been Aya Badir, founder of Little Bits. If you would like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch.